Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host today, Monica Hadley. And with us is Danielle Trussoni, the New York Times bestselling author of The Ancestor, Angelopolis, which were all New York Times notable books, and The Puzzle Master, which was chosen by The Washington Post as one of their best thrillers of 2023. And her memoir, Falling Through the Earth, was selected by The New York Times as one of the top 10 books of the year. Danielle is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And we, of course, are here in Iowa ourselves, and winner of the Michener Copernicus Society of America Fellowship. And her work has been translated into more than 30 languages. The book that we're talking about today is The Puzzle Box. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Danielle.
Thanks, Monica. It's really nice to be here.
Now, are you still in Iowa?
No, I'm not. I haven't been in Iowa for quite a while. I live in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, actually, which is central Mexico and up in the mountains in a very artistic community where I'm the program director of Writers Conference here.
Wow. Is it like a annual conference?
It is. It's been going on for 20 years. I've only been here three of those. But it's a premier international conference with writers from the U.S. and Canada and Mexico all coming together to put on a really great show.
Oh, that is fantastic. How did you get involved with that?
So I was living in New York and I was asked to do an event with the conference, and when I came to San Miguel, I loved it so much that I decided I wanted to stay. And my husband and I moved here with our six-year-old. Well, she was three at the time. Now she's six. I volunteered in the beginning to be part of the conference, right, to help with the conference, to help put it on, after having appeared as a guest. And then slowly have become more integral. And now I'm the program director.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Now, your books, other than your memoir, are they all thrillers? Suspense novels? Kind of thing?
Yeah. So I've written two memoirs, actually.
Okay.
One was my first book, which is called Falling Through the Earth, which is set in the Midwest. Obviously, I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Wisconsin.
Okay.
And the second book, the second memoir I wrote maybe, about 10 years after that first one. And that's called The Fortress. And then that's when I was living in France with my now ex-husband. And those two memoirs are, considered literary memoir. And then the rest of my books, Angelology was a big departure. That was my first novel. And that's really... It's a blend of literary fiction and sort of Dan Brown-esque adventure with lots of historical elements sort of woven in. And that's really, I think, what people see my writing as being, is that kind of blend of a couple of genres, like, you know, sort of a certain quality of writing plus, you know, a fast plot and interesting characters.
Oh, cool. So is the puzzle box kind of a sequel to The Puzzle Master?
You could call it a sequel. The thing is there's the same main character who is an ingenious puzzle solver. This is also a Midwesterner. His name is Mike Brink, and he, when he was 17, he was a football star, but was hit really hard on the field and has a traumatic brain injury that left him with a gift. He's very good at math. He has a photographic memory, and he can solve puzzles better than anyone else in the world. So he appears in The Puzzle Master, which was published last year. And he also now appears in The Puzzle Box, which was just released. But they are not necessarily, it's not necessary to read one before the other. They have a totally separate stories, and you could pick up the second book, for example, and read that first.
Which I did. So, and yes.
Oh, great.
But I could tell,
and it was
it was absolutely fine. But there were some references to some past history with certain characters. And I thought, okay, there was definitely a book one to this, but you didn't need that. You actually did a great job at providing the information that the reader needs to understand the plot. Now, you lived in Japan for 2 years, and that is part of the inspiration for this novel, correct?
Correct. So I, as you probably have gathered, like to live all over the place. And I lived in Japan when I was just out of college. I was hired to teach English in a high school in southern Japan, and I loved it. It was just one of these amazing, life-changing experiences for me.
Now, did you speak Japanese when you went, before you went?
No.
Oh, my goodness.
No. And you know, luckily the program was designed. It's a government program that hires American and British and Canadian, actually, college graduates to come in and speak English to high school students so that they can learn English from a native speaker, which is, not easy for people in Japan to hear English, or back then, especially. I mean, now I suppose people can listen to audiobooks and podcasts and that sort of thing and hear English more. But back then, you know, 20 years ago, it was rare for these students to hear English. So they brought us over, and they had a huge program around it. So I was, you know, I was taken care of. I was brought to the school and given housing and stuff. So I didn't need to learn to know Japanese when I came, but I learned some Japanese as I lived there. And when I was there, I've always wanted to write about Japan after that experience, and have just sort of carried around all of this knowledge about that country with me over the years, like sort of just waiting, like when am I going to find a book that I can write, you know, bring Japan in somehow. And after creating this character, this puzzle savant character in The Puzzle Master, I realized that, you know, he could be a really great way to get me to Japan and to write a book about Japan.
So where was the inspiration for this character, for Mike Brink, this savant, this puzzle savant?
Yeah, I don't think he came from any one place. When I was writing The Puzzle Master, I started, it's a mystery as well. I started with a character, a female character named Jess Price, who was in prison for killing someone. And she hadn't spoken about what had happened, but she had drawn an elaborate cipher. And her psychiatrist in the prison calls in Mike Brink, this puzzle savant, to solve it. And so I started with her and her story. I wrote about 150 pages of her story before I decided, oh yeah, there has to be somebody who solves this thing, and started to think of a puzzle constructor. But when he came in, the book became something completely different. Every page that I wrote about him, I felt was on fire. And I was like, so this guy needs to be the hero. So I actually did a lot of work. I took a lot of that original story out and then rewrote it with him as the main character. But originally he was just a kind of average puzzle guy, right? And then when he became the main character, I knew he had to have a special talent.
Okay.
That would make him interesting enough for readers to want to keep reading about him.
So this thing that had happened to him, where he had a traumatic brain injury and ended up being brilliant afterwards, is this based on, I mean, does this actually happen?
So yes, shockingly, it's very, very rare. But what Mike Brink, what this character has, is called savant syndrome. And maybe 50 to 75 people in the world have been diagnosed with this. And it's when the brain, usually the left hemisphere of the brain, is damaged, and there's a kind of hyperplasticity that happens, that the brain changes and adapts. And it's not always that people become brilliant, right? And it's not universally brilliant. Like, he's not brilliant in lots of ways, but he has a very particular skill that developed after this brain injury. For example, when I was doing research about this, I read a story or an account of a guy who had a brain injury, and he after he as he was recovering, he felt this inexplicable compulsion to play the piano, and he started to play. And within, that's what he wanted to do, and he was very good at it suddenly. Like it was a really surprising thing because he had never been interested in music before or ever took a lesson. Within 6 months, he was composing music and he was playing professionally, and that's what he changed his whole life around music to be a musician. That's the kind of thing that has happened to people who have Savant syndrome. With Mike Brink, it's just, it's very narrow. It's about mathematics and patterns and memory, and he has synesthesia, which means that he sees colors when he hears words, and all of this is sort of conjoined to allow this guy to solve elaborate mysteries that happen to be around puzzles.
And his synesthesia is spatial, right? It's a spatial synesthesia.
It's a
So,
space, yes.
yeah, so that he just can recognize patterns and they just sort of play out in his mind. Now, the funny thing is that I started reading your book and there's reference to synesthesia, which I was familiar with before, and then a few days later, I'm at lunch, and a friend of mine starts talking about having spatial synesthesia that she's had since she was a child. And then a week later, an article pops up in my Substack about synesthesia. And it's not something that I hear about or talk about very often, and suddenly it's everywhere.
Yeah, I think, it's a lot more common than we think. And once you start to think about it, the really interesting thing for me about that, about synesthesia and about this character is that it shows us that everybody's brain, like we're all seeing the world slightly differently. And we assume that the person we're having lunch with sees the menu the same way that we do, but maybe that person is seeing some colors overlying those letters because she has synesthesia. And that fascinates me, the way that consciousness is different and the way that people see things differently. That's what made me want to return to that character and write about him in the puzzle box.
So the puzzle, well, actually, let's go in a little bit more into synesthesia. So it's considered a, is it considered a neurodivergence or?
I believe so. I don't know. I haven't done a lot of specific research on synesthesia, but I have done more research into Savant syndrome, which is definitely neurodivergence.
Right. And now it sounds like, oh, you can solve all these puzzles. What's wrong with that? But he had some, there was some downside to it
This is
as
why the
well.
character is interesting to me, actually. If he was Superman and could just, a genius and walk in and do anything he wanted, it would be a little bit boring. But it's the He has a vulnerability too. All of this information is coming to him without him having a lot of control. And so it's too much. His nervous system is a bit fried, if you think of it that way. He has trouble sleeping. He has trouble making connections with people. He has a compulsion to be using this skill because it sort of calms him down and like makes him feel that he, you know that he's doing something important. And but at the same time, he almost wishes that he didn't have this, that he was just a normal person. And actually, the book opens. He has a doctor named Dr. Treffert who has concocted, who has over time, he's been seeing Mike Brink for 10 years or more, and over time has developed a treatment where Mike could potentially take a cocktail of drugs and make it stop. And so that's a question that he has. Do I want to keep this skill, or will I take medication to make it stop?
To be normal,
To
basically.
be normal.
Yeah, whatever that is.
Whatever that is. Which, as someone who is compelled to write fiction and does
Around the
goes
world.
in all around the world and goes in, into an office every day alone and talks makes imaginary people talk to each other, like, yeah, I mean, you wonder, would you do something more normal if you could, or would you continue to do that thing that makes you different.
Yeah. I'm amazed that you've lived so many different places. You know, talk about Wisconsin,
yeah, I really love
Iowa,
it.
New York, France, Japan, and now Mexico. And you're not very old. You know, I'm looking, you know, our listeners aren't seeing you, but I am. And so you must not stay in any one place too long.
Well, I plan to stay here for a while. I stay a couple of years. I like the ability to get to know a place. You know, some people like to travel and they go and they're like, oh, I'm going to go do France or whatever. I'm going to go do Europe for the summer and like travel around on a train. And for me, I feel like I can't really get to know a place unless I spend a year or two there. So it's been, you know, I think during COVID, you heard of people who were digital nomads. And
right,
I guess
right.
I was just doing that long before.
So how is it when you go there? Now, it sounds like you haven't necessarily gone alone because you've gone with the husband or,
yeah.
or something. But have you ever moved to a foreign country alone? And if so, how did you find a social life?
So I always have a program around what I'm, you know, so for example, I lived in London as a student. So, I was in a program where I met other students and I went to Japan with a job. Right. And, and I came here to Mexico with my husband who speaks Spanish. He's French. I met him in France.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm not like willy nilly just showing up at the airport with a suitcase. Like, here I am. there's a lot of planning that goes into it. And if I do go to a place, beforehand, I make sure we have a nice rental, that I have some sort of support network. I'm really careful about it. But because I have done that and put the work into doing that, it's made my life very rich in lots of ways. Like I've learned new languages and I've met people from different countries and I'm learning a lot about culture, you know, different cultures. And that all ends up in my books, because my books are often set in different countries and different places.
All right. So let's go back to this book, The Puzzle Box. What is a puzzle box?
That is a good question. So I wish your listeners could see, because I actually have a puzzle box here. I'm going to show you.
Okay.
This is one that I bought in Japan. And this is from a place called Hakone, Japan, where they make traditional puzzle boxes. And in the novel, The Puzzle Box, let me just tell your listeners quickly how the puzzle box plays a role in the novel. This puzzle solver is invited by the Emperor of Japan to Tokyo to open a large, dangerous puzzle box. It was built in the 19th century, that puzzle box in the novel, and it's holding a secret inside. So a puzzle box is sort of, it looks like a square. You can see this. But if you can see, you can move the pieces just slightly. And if you move, this small one that I'm showing you now is 21 moves. And if you do those moves in the right order, it will open. Kind of, you know, it looks a little bit like an old-fashioned Rubik's Cube, but the top pops off. But in the novel, it's 72 moves, and every one of those moves has the potential of a booby trap, right?
Whoa.
So when our puzzle constructor, our puzzle solver is invited to Japan, he has heard about this legendary puzzle box. It's called the Dragon Box. And he's also well aware that everyone who has tried to solve this box for the past 150 years has died trying. So it's a very dangerous proposition. But of course, because he's our puzzle genius, and because he's compelled to do this and he can't say no, he goes and he does it. But so just to go back to your question about what a puzzle box is, it's wooden, it's very layered. And if you go look, if anyone is interested in seeing some very cool puzzle boxes, there's an American puzzle box maker named Kagen Sound, K-A-G, E-N, I believe it is, Sound, just like regular sound. And if you go to his website, he makes these gorgeous puzzle boxes. And I interviewed him before I wrote this because I wanted to understand how they come together, how they're made, and how they come together, so that when I'm writing about my puzzle genius opening it, it feels tactile and real, and the reader is right there with him opening it.
So when these boxes, are there actual ones that are booby-trapped or,
No,
no,
that's all me. That, that's
okay.
that's my invention. There's where the creative part comes in.
Okay. Now what about, excuse me, what about the idea of a puzzle box that holds some secret that hasn't been able to
Well,
been op that hasn't been opened for
yeah, that's all fiction too.
Okay.
Originally these puzzle boxes did hold precious things, right? People would use them as a kind of safe. And then they could, put, I don't know, money or jewels or something in it and then open it. When I was doing research about puzzle boxes, obviously I read about some of those first uses of these boxes. Now they're really just a game. People collect them because they're beautiful and they like to play them. But I loved this idea that it could hold something and that nobody could get it out. So I just sort of ran with that concept.
I mean, couldn't you just smash
Well,
it?
no, you can't, because it is booby-trapped in a way that it will destroy the thing inside.
Well, yours, yes, but in
Yes.
when they were using them as a safe, I can't imagine it being all that safe.
Probably not, but
Yeah.
probably safer than leaving it sitting on your dresser.
Yes, true, very true. So the now. This novel is based on this puzzle box that was created by the Imperial Family of Japan. And there is a lot of history in the book about the Imperial Family. Is that all drawn from actual history? Well,
Yes.
except
So the
possibly the initial ancestor.
yeah yep well in Japan that's considered history.
Okay.
And so I'll just elaborate on what you mean. So the Japanese imperial family is the longest consecutive royal family in the world. They can trace their lineage back 2,000 years or more, and it's legend, but also it's sort of indoctrinated into the imperial family genealogy that the first ancestor was a goddess named Amaterasu, a sun goddess. And then she bequeathed, supposedly, these objects to the family, and they have been passed down throughout the generations. And interestingly enough, in one aspect of this that was particularly fascinating to me was that throughout these centuries, there have been eight empresses, eight female rulers historically in Japan. But in the 19th century, the Emperor Meiji, who in my book creates this puzzle box, instituted a policy where there could be no more female empresses, female rulers, that the succession must pass down through the male line. And incidentally, and very interestingly enough, right now in Japan, the only heir to the imperial family throne is a woman. So there's a lot of discussion in Japan about whether she should be able to inherit this title or not. And that might seem like I'm often left field talking about this, but this is really woven into the book and it's
Oh,
part of the
yes.
solution of the story.
So, how did this guy, you said it was in the 19th century, this emperor, how did he have the authority to change what had been the tradition up to that point of
Well, he was the
allowing
emperor.
women?
He was the emperor, and there was nobody above him. But yes, it's a good question. Like, why can he do that? And also, but you also have to remember, the British monarchy had primogeniture. All of the other monarchies in the world essentially were structured that way. And so
yeah,
it wasn't
none of
maybe
them,
that.
but none of them claim to have come from a female to begin with.
Goddess. Yes. No. Agree. I mean, I'm in your camp, Monica. Like I think it was ridiculous, but that's what happened, and it was instituted. Some people say that his advisors, because it was instituted in law, right? It was before that, it was just tradition,
right?
Like it was not set. There was no actual written law that a woman or a man could take the throne. It just happened. That was, you know, there was a woman who was the obvious heir, and so she became the empress. And and interestingly enough, Meiji had something like 8 or 9 daughters and like only one surviving son, you know, and it was this, it's kind of a crazy period. That whole period of Japanese history is really interesting. And it was transformative for that country. But so, you know, fast forward, now it's 2024, and there is a very bright, very popular woman who should be inheriting the throne. And they've gone around here and named a cousin, a male cousin, the person who gets it. So it's a controversy, and the book explores that.
Now, I didn't even realize that they still had this imperial family, because I thought World War II sort of put an end to it. And it did change things. So can you explain what changed about the imperial family at the end of World War II?
Well, at the end of World War II, the emperor had to renounce his divinity. That was the big thing. You know, there was from that time previously, the emperor was considered a god. And when you would walk in, when regular people or even his close advisors would walk into a room where he was, they couldn't look at him. There was all of this ritual around the emperor. And the Americans, rightly so, believed that that had allowed him to take control of people in a way that they might not have allowed themselves to be controlled if he was just a regular human being, a regular leader. And so he signed a declaration that he was not divine. And there were a lot of other things that happened too. There were a lot of imperial property was seized and distributed in to people and to the government. And it became more secular. So that changed. And a lot of this is sort of the background for this story. And really sets it up, about gives the stakes of why opening this box is really important for Mike Brink.
So before World War II, the emperor controlled government. He was in charge.
Well, so there's a lot of history around this, because he had advisors. A lot of people believed, and it's probably true, that the emperor was kind of a puppet, right? Like, he had a whole slew of advisors who were much more powerful and pulling the strings. So, you know, whether or not he himself, right, the emperor himself was making those decisions or not, no, I don't know.
Okay. But then after that, see, I know very little about Japanese government. Do they have like a parliament now? Do they have elections?
You know, I don't know that much either. There are elections. There's prime ministers. You know, there are the imperial family is much like the British monarchy.
So more of a figurehead.
They're symbolic.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
They're completely symbolic. They are actually not doing any sort of ruling. But they still, as I think I mentioned in the book, they are out doing public events almost every day of the year. They have an exhausting schedule, and they are very much in the public mind. You know, people, it's a little bit like the British royal family. There are people who stake themselves outside of the imperial palace in Tokyo and take pictures, and they know everything that, you know, that everyone's wearing. And it's very much symbolic.
When you set out to write this story, did you have to do a lot of research into this Japanese history?
Absolutely. I knew the sort of environment, Japanese environment from living there, and I knew a lot about Japanese culture, but I didn't know much of anything about the Japanese imperial family. And so that part of the research was very much like me getting books, right? And reading everything I could, doing a lot of research online, doing a lot of research into this controversy that I mentioned. And then I went to Japan in March of 2023. My husband and I went, and we actually, by that point, I had a rough draft of the book, and I was going to the places that appear in the book, and I was actually doing sort of on the ground research where I would take pictures and make sure that it worked, like that the spaces worked in the book. And that was a lot of fun. One thing that I want people, readers to take away from the book, like it sounds pretty heavy with all the research and everything, but it's a lot of fun. And I wanted it to move fast. And I wanted people to feel like they were on an adventure through a foreign country, or a country that they, would be learning stuff about the culture in the country. So, going there and making sure that those locations worked well and were interesting and visually well described in the book was really important to me.
Now, you also, there's another concept that's pretty important in this book that we haven't really dealt with yet, and that is AI, artificial intelligence. Why and how did that, it seems like quite a departure from ancient puzzle boxes.
Yeah, well, I wanted this novel to feel contemporary. There's a lot of ancient history here, and there's a lot, you'll learn a lot when you're reading this book, you'll learn a lot about history in Japan and these sort of gorgeous, beautiful places in Japan but I also really wanted it to feel like it's of the moment. And so I don't think it's giving too much away to say that the villain in the book has an AI element. And when I was trying to create a villain, I was thinking like, what is the scariest thing for me right now? And for me, I'm really afraid of how dependent we are on technology, how every aspect of our life, from our bank accounts to our medical treatments to everything that we have, it's all
In that
digital.
phone. It's
In
all in
that
our
phone,
phones.
and right, and if something, right, if an intelligent digital consciousness, let's just call it that, could get into that, imagine the havoc and the pain that it could cause us. We all want to think of AI as something that maybe can help us, and like it can write some emails for us, or it can, I don't know, give us answers to questions that we have that we don't want to take the time to go look up. But there are some philosophers who are stuck very, very seriously studying and debating the potential dangers of AI, and some of them believe it's apocalyptic, that AI could get into computer systems that control nuclear warheads, or they could get into government computers, and it's all very scary. So anyway, that's a long way of saying that I just wanted to create a kind of scary villain, and I feel like he's a good villain for Mike Brink because Mike Brink has the super brain power, and AI is like right up there with him.
Right. And of course, it doesn't even necessarily have to be an artificial consciousness. A human consciousness, an actual physical being, could get control through technology in the same way.
Totally.
And probably does. This probably happens more than we realize. So the characters in your book, when they're on the run, they can't use their phones. They can't have their phones.
It's also a way of, so this book is an action thriller, right? It's a way of removing technology from solving part of the clues. Back when, if you read Agatha Christie, excuse me, or if you read 19th century detective fiction, they don't have all of the technology. They don't have the cell phones that, if you call someone, it just destroys all of the tension of the mystery. And so I really wanted to create I guess, sort of artificially create a way to remove the technology. And so by instituting it like Uber technology, like AI, in this story, it also made it handicapped the characters in a way that they weren't able to use their cell phones and like map out their journey with Google Maps or something. They really had to find their way through just the old fashioned, let's just see if we can get there.
I have to admit, I was like, when they need to get on this train, I'm like, well, how are they going to pay for the train ticket? And you didn't actually say how they paid for the train ticket, because if they use their credit card, it's going to then.
Yeah, they didn't pay. They just got on. Yeah. And the interesting thing about the trains in Japan, so I went on the trains in Japan, the bullet train, which is what they're on in that scene, often there's not someone coming along to check those tickets. They just give you the benefit of the doubt, especially at night.
Okay.
This is a midnight train.
Okay.
So,
well, that's good, because I was worried all along that they were going to get kicked off the train.
Well, it might have been better for them if they got kicked off, because there was a dangerous guy lurking in one of the cars.
Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Danielle Trissoni, author of The Puzzle Box. Danielle, would you like to read a little bit from the book for us?
I would love that. I'm going to read, so there's a prologue, and that is set in Japan. I'm not going to read that. I'm going to read the first chapter with the hero, Mike Brink. And it is it's about 5 pages. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So New York City, February 22nd, 2024, the year of the wood dragon. Mike Brink held his dachshund Conundrum, Connie for short, tight by the leash. It was a freezing Thursday morning in February, and yet Columbus Park was packed with dogs, Dobermans and Collies, Golden Retrievers and Labradoodles, pugs and poodles. Connie strained against her leash, desperate to join the other dogs. Brink understood her impulse to run wild, that exuberant momentum that pulled her toward the melee of dogs racing and jumping through fresh fallen snow. Bending to her, he unclipped the leash, and she bounded away, leaping and yelping, filled with the ebullient energy of a creature on a scent. Brink took a deep breath, exhaled, and watched the air freeze around him. It felt good to walk through the snow, a cup of hot coffee in hand, a morning paper under his arm. Good to be alive at a moment in time when, despite everything wrong with the world, and he couldn't read the news without finding 1,000 things wrong, he could rely on good coffee, the daily crossword, and a park where his dog could run free. Opening the New York Times, he rifled through the sections until he found the games page. His puzzle was front and center, his byline in bold. His editor, Will Shorts, had asked him to make a modestly challenging number puzzle, and he delivered a triangulum. To solve it, one put a number from 1 to 6 in each circle. Identical numbers could not be put in the same gray line. He'd put a few sums in the circles, and the solutions touching each circle had to add up to that sum. His gig as a regular contributor to the games page was only one of Mike Brink's distinctions. He was considered by and large to be one of the most talented puzzle masters in the world. 6 months before, he'd been featured on 60 Minutes. The interview dug into his past and the traumatic brain injury that had transformed him from a teenaged football star to a mathematical genius with a seemingly endless ability to solve impossible puzzles. He was described as having nuclear brain power, and embarrassing memes of explosions ended up all over social media. Since then, he'd stopped giving interviews. Brink found the attention disconcerting. He preferred the private pursuit of making puzzles to being in the public eye. And yet, after he'd solved what came to be known as the God puzzle, a cipher that was the key to a murder in upstate New York, his name was everywhere. His refusal to discuss what happened, not on any of the morning shows, not even with Colbert, his favorite talk show host, only made him more mysterious. He was called an eccentric, a reclusive genius, damaged. And if he was honest, that assessment wasn't far from the truth. Damaged. The word resonated with Mike Brink. Pete spent the past decades learning to live with the traumatic brain injury that left him with Savant syndrome, a rare medical disorder in which the injured brain, in a frenzy of plasticity, becomes overdeveloped. For Brink, the result was an astonishing gift. He could solve the most difficult, elaborate problems with ease. He saw the world as a series of interlocking patterns. He had a photographic memory, an astonishing facility to learn and retain information, and could untangle the most impossible puzzles without trying. His gift was a superpower, but it was also his biggest obstacle. He struggled to live a normal life and to feel good in his own skin. While there was no outward sign of damage, he was charming, athletic, and popular with his friends and colleagues. Under the surface, Mike Brink was filled with anxiety. The injury had left him with a damaged nervous system, insomnia, and synesthesia, a condition in which his senses mixed, causing a distortion of colors and sounds. Dr. Trevors, a neuroscientist who had worked with Brink from the beginning and had even relocated his practice from the Midwest to New York City to be nearby, speculated that synesthesia was responsible for his mathematical and mnemonic gifts. Your brain experiences patterns the way a normal brain experiences danger, Dr. Trevors had once told him. When you encounter a challenge, there's a release of chemicals similar to those released when one is threatened or when one falls in love. The result is a super salience that feels like connection, like everything makes sense. But these chemicals wear off. Your need to engage with obstacles is a way of getting more of them. Your brain is like a thrill seeker, forever raising the bar. You need more difficult, more dangerous challenges just to feel normal. You put yourself in psychic danger to feel alive. And it was true. Brink craved strenuous acts of solving, 10, 12, 14-hour contests that exhausted him physically and mentally, brought a day or two of peace, sometimes more, but then the cycle would begin again. With Dr. Trevor's assistance, he found ways to manage his condition. Meditation, diet, and exercise all helped to a certain extent, but only momentarily. Like taking an aspirin to mask a headache, the effects wore off, often leaving Brink feeling everything he'd felt before. Making it even harder was the fact that his internal struggle wasn't visible to other people. He was regarded as a great success, a handsome and boyish genius, a man who had everything. And while his high profile and his unrelenting schedule of international puzzle competitions created a bubble around him, he found himself longing for the simple things of a normal existence. Friends, family, the comfort of being just a regular guy living a regular life. This longing would have seemed absurd to the outside world. Everyone believed that success and fame made him happy. In reality, the physical and psychological effects of his injury were a slow, ever-present form of torture. Coming to terms with his gift was the hardest challenge Mike Brink would ever face. Your brain is a labyrinth, Dr. Trevors had once said. The most challenging puzzle you will ever confront is yourself. Brink took the final sip of his coffee and was folding the newspaper under his arm when he noticed a woman watching from the edge of the park. There were dozens of people at the dog run. It was a popular time at the park, 7:30 on a Thursday morning. But for some reason, this woman stood out. When he met her eye, she didn't blink, but watched him, her gaze tracking him. Something about the equanimity of her expression, the way she seemed to recognize him but made no sign of approach, made him feel uncomfortable. As did her attire. It was frigid, the wind sharpened to a point, and yet she wore nothing but a black blazer over a hot pink t-shirt. Her hair was windswept, with a thick strand dyed bright blue. She was Asian, young, and wore no hat, no gloves, not even a scarf. It was as though she didn't feel the sub-zero wind at all. Brink pulled a rubber ball from his jacket pocket and threw it to Connie. His fingers stung with cold. He rubbed them together and glanced back at the woman. The wind didn't even faze her. What did she want? Why was she looking at him like that? It was possible that she'd recognized him. It didn't happen often. People knew Mike Brink's puzzles, not his face. Still, occasionally, someone would approach him, one of his puzzles in hand, and ask for an autograph or a selfie. but this woman wasn't holding one of his puzzle books, and she didn't seem like the type of person to pose for pictures. Deciding to ignore her, he threw the ball to Connie a few more times, then clipped the leash onto her collar and headed home. He'd completely forgotten about the woman from the park until he walked up the 5 flights of stairs to his loft and found her waiting at his front door. Her skin was raw from the cold, her cheeks bright pink, her black leather Doc Martens covered in salt and snow from the sidewalks. Clearly, she'd run from the park. That explained how she beat him to his apartment. It didn't explain how she knew where he lived. "Hey there," she said, looking him over. "Didn't mean to startle you." She offered her hand. "I'm Sakura, Sakura Nakamoto. Can you talk a minute?" Her name was Japanese, but she spoke to him in colloquial, unaccented English. He shook her hand. "Mike Brink. I know who you are." Before he could respond, she reached into the pocket of her blazer and, like a magician conjuring a dove from a hat, removed a small wooden box and placed it in the palm of his hand. She stepped away carefully, as if the box were dangerous, a delicate thing wired with explosives. Brink stared at it, amazed. There, light as a pack of cards in his palm, was a Japanese puzzle box. Turning the box over, he examined it from all sides. It was simple, elegant, the wood surface glossy and smooth. He glanced back at Sakura. Why in the world had she followed him from the park to give him a puzzle box? She bowed, a formal gesture that seemed out of place in the dingy vestibule outside his loft. "In the name of the Emperor of Japan, please accept this challenge." Brink caught his breath as her meaning became clear. The woman was not an intrepid fan. She hadn't followed him home looking for an autograph. She'd brought an invitation to solve the most challenging and mysterious puzzle in the world, the Dragon Puzzle Box.
And that was Danielle Trissoni reading from The Puzzle Box. Now, the Dragon Puzzle Box is your invention, correct?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, totally.
Now, are you a puzzle enthusiast yourself?
So I am very bad at puzzles. I do like to play that. I do like them. I'm more of a word puzzle person. I like Wordle a lot.
How about
do you play Wordle?
I play Wordle, Connections, and Strand every day. Every day.
I love them. And, you know, it doesn't mean I'm not Mike Brink by any stretch of the imagination, but I do enjoy them. And I really like jigsaw puzzles. And I feel like, you know, that when I relax, you know, I don't have that much time for jigsaw puzzles right now in my life, but I do really enjoy them.
Me too. And I never do them because I don't have time. But
yeah.
You know, puzzles are kind of having a moment, aren't they?
I think so. And I think people need to escape, to be honest. You know, when I do a puzzle like that, I want to escape and just engage my mind in a way that's not anxiety provoking or bringing in, you know, the world outside or politics or whatever into my head. And, you know, writing the puzzle box was sort of like doing a puzzle for me, right? Like I really wanted to create something that was fun and would be engaging intellectually, but also just really fast and away from the world.
Now, did you know what the solution was all along?
Yeah, I did. I had an outline. I'm this kind of book that moves, you know, with such intricate pieces. I mean, mm-hmm. Some people have told me that they feel like reading the book feels a little bit like solving a puzzle. And to have those intricate pieces, I really needed to have an outline first.
So how long do you spend doing the outline?
The outline, it's really variable. But this one took about 2 months.
Okay. And then how long do you spend writing?
And this, I took about a year to write this book.
Okay. And is that pretty typical for you?
No, this was faster than usual. It usually takes me a couple years to write a book.
Wow. Are there really international puzzle solving contests?
There really are. Go on YouTube. I didn't know that, but I discovered it.
What kind of puzzles do they have? What do they – are they numerical mostly? Or?
They're all different. There's the pie competition where people are – you know, reciting pie places. And the world champion, I think, is 114,000 pie places that someone can stand in a room in front of judges and repeat, which is just astonishing. There's Rubik's Cube competition, so like speed cubing, it's called. There's all different kinds of competitions. And yeah, it's fascinating. That world was completely unknown to me until I started writing this book.
You know, I consider myself pretty good at a lot of things, a lot of puzzles, very good with numbers. I can often, as an, you know, my background as an accountant, and I could look at something that somebody else is trying to figure out what's wrong, and I can point right to the where the problem is. I cannot do a Rubik's Cube. I cannot.
It's hard. I can't either. I can't do a lot of the puzzles in my own books. I did not create those puzzles. So for, you know, for those who don't have a book in front of them, there's some visual puzzles that are in the book. I mean, you don't need to know how to solve them to get, you know, to the next page. I write the solution in there. But for people who like puzzles, they can take out a pencil and actually do the puzzle in the book.
Yeah. So what is, you know, it's like, how is it that some people are so good at mechanical puzzles and someone else it's numerical and someone else it's word and someone else it's jigsaw, but Mike Brink was good at all of them?
Well, so that's the fascinating thing about the human mind, right? The human brain. We are all good at different things. And we are all, I firmly believe we are all seeing the world slightly differently than each other. So, that it really makes you sensitive to other people and appreciate that we're all just a little bit different.
That's a very good point. And that really is kind of the theme, isn't it?
Yeah. And being content with that, you know, there's the learning to accept our strengths and weaknesses and just be happy with, not happy, but content with who we are and what we can do.
So I wanted to ask you, I mentioned in the intro that you're the winner of the Michener Copernicus Society of America Fellowship. What is that?
Yeah. So that's something that comes from the Iowa Writers Workshop, or it's nominated by the Iowa Writers Workshop, and it's for one graduate in that year, and it's a $25,000 fellowship to help you finish your first book.
And your first book was?
Falling Through the Earth, which was a memoir. Wow. About my relationship with my father, who was a Vietnam vet.
Now, in this book, in the puzzle box, there's also one other element we haven't really discussed, which was I can't remember the word for the esoteric element.
Right.
So how does that fit in to this?
Well, there's a character. It fits in through a character named Rachel, who is kind of Mike Brink's right-hand, you know, person. They're really good friends. In The Puzzle Master, if you read that book, that's the book that I wrote before this one. She plays a large role in solving the cipher, which has some mystical elements to the cipher. And Mike Brink is really not someone who has a whole lot of esoteric knowledge or even believes in it. But Rachel really does. And she thinks that this injury that Mike has is like a portal into understanding mysticism.
And this dragon box certainly has some mystical purpose.
Or
people believe it has a mystical purpose.
People believe they do.
Yeah,
and there's a whole sort of sub backstory of them, you know, the villain, right? The villain and a group of people trying to collect these objects. You know, one of them is the puzzle box and what's in it. Because they think it will give them kind of keys to understanding, I don't know, esoteric or ancient knowledge we've lost.
Yeah, and that's such an appealing thing for a lot of people, the idea that there's this ancient knowledge that, yeah, like you said, that we've lost. And I know some people who really are into that kind of thing.
Yeah, I do too. And I actually have done a lot of research into it, and I'm into that kind of thing. You know, theoretically, I'm not practicing any kind of mystical practice, but I think it's fascinating. You know, I love when people try to make sense of the world, right? And that's one system that people try to make sense of the world. I think science and mathematics and kind of these puzzle things are another way that people can make sense of the world, numbers. And I'm sort of, in the middle, looking as a novelist, looking at all of these systems and just fascinated with very human desire to understand our existence in our world.
Now, Danielle, you've written two books with Mike Brink as the main character. Are you going to continue with him?
I
Because
hope so.
there's a lot of puzzles out there to be solved.
There's a lot of puzzles, and I feel like Mike Brink could solve all of them, but I don't know. My publisher wants to see how this book goes, right? So that's, they're waiting to see it. And so far, it was a national bestseller so far, and it just was chosen by Publishers Weekly as a best book of 2024. So critically, it seems to be doing well, and there's some sales. So let's see what Random House decides to do.
Are you working on on the next book already?
I have an outline of it, but I haven't started. I want to wait until I know for sure that they want to publish it. But I have a lot of, I'm one of those writers that has like four projects on the back burners, right? Like, so I have
Whoa.
other idea. I have a whole bunch of ideas, and I'm just waiting for the moment where I decide on which one I'm going to work on.
Do you have any of the proverbial book in the drawer?
Yeah, I mean, not one that I've, not a finished
Not
one.
a
I
finished
have,
one.
no, I have, there's a novella that I wrote recently that is in a drawer that I'm thinking, that could be expanded to be more, more hefty and a novel, so I have that, but no, I have a lot of ideas in the drawer. I tend to be a little conservative in that I wait until I'm really sure that that idea is going to work, and then I just work on it to death. Like, I work on it till it's at such a level that I know that it can get published.
Now,
And that's, yeah, and they get published then.
at what point did you decide you wanted to be a fiction writer? When did you know that that was your career?
So I always wrote, little things when I was growing up. So my mom always says, "You're the only person I know that said she wanted to be something as a kid and then was that thing." Right? Because when I was, I was a big reader as a child, and I was that kid you'd see in the library with a huge stack of books, and librarians would say, "You're not going to ever read all these," but I actually would. I just admired writing and novels so much that that's what I wanted to do. I had no idea how to do that, right? I came from, a small town in the Midwest, and there were not writers that I knew. And so it was a long journey to figure out how to actually do that. But I really knew when I was like a kid. And when I was 16, I was writing short stories, and my undergraduate was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I was in their creative writing program. And so I knew pretty young. It's been I'm now going on, I don't want to say how old I am, but 25 years of working on it.
And were there times, well, obviously you were teaching English and so forth, so, but now is writing kind of your day job?
Yeah, writing has been my only job somehow all of my life. I've done little things like I was a columnist for the New York Times Book Review, and I took side gigs as I thought of them like that. And I have taught in MFA programs and stuff like that too. But it's always that Monday through Friday or Monday through Saturday, 8 a.m. to noon, I'm in my office writing.
So that's your routine.
That's my
Yeah.
routine, yeah.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. There aren't too many people who've been able to do that their whole life,
Thank
you
you.
know?
It's, I feel like a gymnast or an acrobat, right? Doing
Yeah.
lots of contortions with my life so that it works.
Well, Danielle, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us. I enjoyed the puzzle box. It was a really fun to read. And
I'm so glad to hear that.
we always close with the quote, and I found this from Richard Dawkins. The solution often turns out more beautiful than the puzzle.
I love that. Well, what a brilliant way to end this.
Well,
Thank you so
thank
much,
you,
Monica.
and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.